So this summer, my family and I, thanks to a great deal, were able to get season passes to the Six Flags that's just over here in Maryland. They had like crazy deals where it was basically the same price for like one ticket normally for a season pass. So we kind of had the same route that was going back and forth off of 495. And I've noticed for me that when I'm driving around here and I have to use the GPS or I'm using it because I don't know what the traffic might be, I don't know about you, but sometimes I get like in an internal argument with the GPS where I'm like, that doesn't make sense. Like, why would I take that route? And so this route that we were coming back from, the Six Flags, always had this spot where I was looking on the map and it was like I could go straight for what looked like a couple hundred feet, or it took me in this roundabout thing, which was a lot longer, and it kept taking me the roundabout thing. And I kept just being like, okay, I guess I'll follow you. But every time I did, I was like, I don't think this is right. Like, this is dumb. This is just a short little, like, maybe one, two light thing, and there's lights this way as well. I don't think this knows what it's talking about. I'm gonna try my own thing. So one of the last days we did it, I was like, forget it. I'm going to ignore the GPS's guidance. I'm going to make up my own. I'm going to go with my own gut and decided to get in this line and then waited and waited and waited because those lights, for whatever reason, didn't move. It was like way too many cars on too many short streets with too much stuff. And so I think it actually ended up costing me 10 minutes because I decided to ignore the GPS and do my own thing. And so I just waited, and after that, I was like, okay, I guess the GPS knew what it was talking about this time. But today, what we're going to look at is a time where, in the Bible, where David kind of ignores God and decides to go his own way, and what happens because of that. And as we're exploring that, I kind of want us to have in our mind, when is it and how is it that we decide to go our own way as we look at this? And so we're going to be looking at 2 Samuel chapters 19 and 20 this morning. This is kind of the last sermon on our series. We'll just wait. I've never had a school announcement before. That's a first. That's fine. All right. So we've actually been looking at the kind of the gospel according to David, David's life here, some of the things that we can learn. And there's so many great things that we can learn from David. Okay. We're okay. And so we're going to be looking at this. Before we pick it up in 1920, 1920 is actually right after where Pastor Steve was talking about last week of some of, like, Absalom is actually his son, has actually put himself up as king, has chased his dad, David, out, has actually tried to fight to kill David, was pursuing him to kill him, but Absalom is defeated, and he's dead, and that's what we're picking it up there. But before we jump into that, I just want to, like, jump back to, like, the beginning of 2 Samuel, just to give you a real quick, brief synopsis. I'm not going to read it, but in case you're not familiar with David's story at all, what happens is David is early on anointed as a kid as going to be the next king over Israel. But after that, he kind of rises in fame a bit because he defeats Goliath. But then Saul, the actual king, gets jealous and tries to kill David, chases David out of Israel across the Jordan. He has to flee for his life by the current king. Then he has a whole kind of thing there. Then Saul dies. Okay, when Saul dies, it seems like, okay, and not just Saul, but most of Saul's family dies, the way is paid for David to take the king, or to become king, but what David does in that moment is he asks the Lord, God, what should I do? And God says, go to Hebron. When he goes to Hebron, which is a city in Judah, so he crosses back over into Israel, he gets to Hebron, and then the whole tribe of Judah says, hey, David, we want to make you king. So they make David king. And you fast track a little bit forward, he becomes king of all the tribes of Israel. And right when he becomes the king of everybody, the Philistines, the enemies, hear about this. And they immediately challenge his kingship by saying, we're going to take out David. And so they rise up in like an army to take David out. And David's response in that moment in like 2 Samuel 5 was to say, God, what should I do? And then God says, hey, God gives David some directions on when to fight, how to fight. And they defeat the Philistines at that point. and kind of in the chapter there of like 2 Samuel 5, the whole story of David becoming king is actually this kind of one of like victory and triumph and celebration and joy. And it's so clear that God is on it. And there's lots of David asking God what to do. And there's lots of, like David even says at one point, it is clear that God has established me as king because of how God's hand has been here. So I want you to have that kind of general story in your mind as we look at this, because sometimes we don't give the biblical authors credit because we just think like they wrote something down and we don't think they might have been using like good literary technique to like make you think of other things as you're reading it. And as the people of Israel would have been reading these words, they would have had this story kind of in their mind as a backdrop of this is how it went and as we get to here. So we're going to kind of just pick out some portions to read, and then I'm going to sum up some other parts of 2 Samuel 19 and 20 because it's two chapters, and I don't think we want me to just sit here and read it. So, but please, by all means, have your Bibles up or your devices up. You can be looking and following kind of some of the things I'm summarizing. But I'm just going to read this in 2 Samuel 19, verse 1. We're going to read a couple verses here. So it says, Joab was told, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom, and for the whole army. The victory that day was turned into mourning because on that day the troops heard it said, the king is grieving for his son. The men stole into the city that day as men steal in who are ashamed when they flee from battle. The king covered his face and cried aloud, O my son, Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son. What we see here is the grief of David. In some sense, he has been grieved before this. As Pastor Steve mentioned last week, there's been lots of tough things that David's had to deal with. But there seems to be like, kind of, you know, this broke him. This was like one thing extra, that one thing more, and he is now just weeping, mourning. Even though this was the guy in the army that was trying to come after him, he's so broken that there's not victory here. They won. They're victorious. His side is victorious, and yet it feels like they've been defeated. And that's kind of the beginning here of what happens. And then we go on, and David, he kind of makes amends. He kind of goes out and says, okay, I'm here. We won, and people are with him. And then even though he's won the battle, everybody hasn't said, we're with you. The people who are part of the other army, mostly Israelites, still haven't invited David back. They're kind of wondering, should we do it? Maybe we do, maybe we don't. And then David kind of just takes it into his own hands. And in verse 11, it says, King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar the priest. Ask the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to this to his palace? Since what is being said throughout Israel has reached the king in his quarters, you are my brothers and my own flesh and blood. So why should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my own flesh and blood? May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if from now on you are not the commander of my army in place of Joab. Now, to understand part of what's happening here is David hasn't been invited back, right? Some of Israel is talking about maybe we should bring him back. And then David decides, I've got it. I'm going to go convince Judah to bring me back. I'm going to talk them into it. Right, and actually says he won over their hearts, all the men of Judah, as though they were one person. And so he basically goes and convinces them, persuades them to do this. And part of his technique of doing that is by saying, your general, the one that just tried to kill him, by the way, this is the guy who was leading the forces that were coming after David to kill him. So all of his current soldiers that have been loyal with him would know this guy is the guy that just tried to kill all of us and did kill some of the men. And David's like, I'm going to make you in charge instead of Joab. You know, the guy who's been my commander, like, my entire reign. I'm going to replace him with you, and then you'll, you know, we'll be there. And he wins them over with this. And so people are like, oh, okay. I have to wonder, as we're thinking about this, Joab is the same guy who did all of that, but Joab's also the same guy who is the one who actually killed Absalom, and David would have known that. And so you have to wonder, as you're seeing this, as David's kind of making these plans, is this like what God has designed, or is this just something David's cooking up as a way to go forward? And he's saying, hey, you know what? I know I can win back Judah, and I can get back at the guy who killed my son. Then we see, I'm not going to read this, but we go, and the son of Jonathan, Mephibosheth, we find out that he's been like slandered, and injustice has been done to him, and David had given all of his lands away to his servant who lied about it. And basically David just is like, oh, okay, well, I guess he slandered. Whatever, you guys just split the land. Which isn't really a great justice kind of piece of a king actually investigating and coming to the bottom and doing real justice. It's just kind of the picture of a man who's like, I don't really care. Let's just move on and take care of it. And then we get over to, they come back. Judah is bringing David back, right? They've crossing the Jordan. And then all the rest of Israel is like, what's going on? Like, why weren't we invited? Why weren't we part of bringing the king back? What's happening? And instead of David or Judah or anybody saying, oh, it's no big deal, it's this thing, basically they start insulting each other. And there starts being harsh words that are given back and forth. And actually, it's kind of one of these, like, you know, almost where you're like doing an insulting, you know, like as kids when you were like somebody would insult you and you have to like, oh, I have to find up a better way to insult you. That's kind of the picture that's happening here in the end of chapter 19 is where they're like, hey, here's my insult. And like, oh yeah, well, here's my insult. And then they just keep going back and forth. And it gets to the place where we start off in chapter 20 and this man says, hey, what do we have to do with you? We're leaving. Bye. Like, they've basically been so insulted, they're like, we don't want anything to do with this. This is how you're going to treat us. We don't want to be here. And so instead of this joyous reconciliation of the people of Israel, even though Judah is now with David, they've been split. And so they run off. And actually, he kind of runs off and is like, we're going to be our own thing. And so then in verse 4 of chapter 20, it says this. Then the king said to Amasa, who he just made his commander, summon the men of Judah to come to me within 3 days and be here yourself. But when Amasa went to summon Judah, he took longer than the time the king had set for him. David said to Abishai, now Sheba, son of Berechi, will do us more harm than Absalom did. Take your master's men and pursue him, or he will find fortified cities and escape from us. So Joab's men and the Kerethites and Pelethites and all the mighty warriors went out under the command of Abishai. They marched out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, son of Berechi. So what's happened here is this guy says, you treated us badly, we're leaving. And David says, no, this isn't good. Now it's going to be even worse than before. They're going to come after us, or war is going to happen. And if we let this guy have any amount of time, he's going to raise up forces for himself. And so we have to kill him. So he orders this guy, hey, go out, get some people, and then you can lead them to victory as my new commander. But the time that David had appointed is like, hey, you've got 3 days, comes and goes. And David responds kind of out of fear. He's kind of like, whoa, we got to do this now, or it's not going to be good. And so he says, okay, I know I made this guy my commander, but you, Abishai, who's actually Joab's brother, who's been replaced by Amasa, he's like, you actually take the guys and lead them to go do it, and that'll be good. Now, I think also this reminds me of something. If you remember, you may not, but beginning of King Saul's reign, the Philistines were against them, and his people were starting to flee, and he was supposed to wait there for Samuel to come and offer a sacrifice. And Saul freaks out because he's worried about what's going to happen. And so he goes ahead and doesn't wait and takes action, and he actually offers a sacrifice himself. And that act actually was when God says through Samuel, now the kingdom will be taken from your family line and given to another. And as I read this, it is written in a way that is very similar and reminds me of that moment. And what we see here is David is a king right now who is not one that is being ruled by God, is not one that is seeking God, is not one that is relying on God. We see here a man who is broken and is making his own way forward. And so here he is, he comes up with this plan. He says, okay, Abishai, you go, you lead these people, because I'm afraid that if we don't act right now, that I'm going to lose this kingdom again. So we have to act right now. And he sends them off. And what we see in the rest of verse or chapter 20 is that what happens is Joab meets Amasa with the people, with the army. Joab murders Amasa, leaves him wallowing in his own blood on the road until somebody moves him. And then they go to take out this guy who's run away to basically the farthest town he can get to in Israel. So this guy that David's so scared of has literally run as far away as he can get in Israel. Joab pursues him with this army. There's no army around this guy. Joab pursues him all the way to this town, immediately starts laying siege to this town. And a wise woman of the town says, "Hey, what are you doing?" Now, what you might not be aware of is back in like Leviticus in these times when God was giving them rules, it was actually mentioned as a rule that when you came to a town and you were going to besiege it, you were supposed to like give them like offer of surrender. Like tell them, "Hey, we're here, we're going to destroy you, but if you don't, we can like talk." But Joab doesn't do that. Joab just comes, he lays siege, and this woman is like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "Oh, well, we just want this one guy. If you kill this guy for us, we'll be on our way." And so she convinces the town, and he says, "Yeah, let's just kill this guy and do it." Now, they do that, and then David's rule is established. And the end of 20 is just like, these are the guys who are ruling, and that's it. And so here's this whole picture of what has happened for the restoration of it. And if you actually pay attention in these two chapters, you'll notice something interesting. Other than people taking vows, like, you know, "God strike me down if I don't do this," kind of things, God's name isn't mentioned once. Other than those vows, God's not mentioned. Not in any kind of "God, we seek you." Not in any kind of "God gave them victory." Not in any kind of "this is what God was doing." It's not here. And I have to think that this is very intentional from the authors that would point us out to the sense of, wait a second, this is supposed to be a glorious moment of David coming back as king, right? He's being restored and reclaimed and all of these things. And yet, what we see here in these two chapters is people being murdered. We see conniving and manipulation and lazy justice, and we see things that are just going, what is this? Honestly, as you read these two chapters and you've been with David for this time, you're going, this doesn't feel like David. This doesn't look like the David I know. This doesn't feel like the kingdom of Israel that we've come to know and love. This is something different. And I think that the main reason is that in these chapters, we see that David doesn't seek the Lord and he doesn't rely on him. He doesn't seek the Lord and he doesn't rely on the Lord. And because he doesn't do these things, he's seeking his own wisdom or wisdom of other people in his own way. He's carving his own path forward because that's what makes sense to him in that moment. And what we see is his plan, while it works, is full of pain and brokenness and death for many people. And I have to wonder, did anything that happened here in 19 and 20 need to happen if David had simply said, "Okay, God, my son is dead, what now? What do you want me to do now?" Remember, when Saul died, that's what he did. Actually, the story I told you before is mirrored here very closely. Before, a king, the one who was king, chased David away. Here, also a king had chased him away. Again, the king died. Here, his son, who was set up as the king at that point, dies. But the responses are so dramatically different. Every time before, even when his kingship was threatened by an external force, he seeks the Lord. Here, his kingdom is threatened by an internal source, he doesn't seek the Lord. And I think it's what makes all the difference. Is David in his brokenness and his own humanity of him making the decisions, him making his way forward, is just as flawed as any of us. And while his plans do get him what his desired result was, it did so in a broken, painful way that left a wake of destruction in their midst. know about you, but I don't want to get where I'm going in life leaving a wake of destruction. I don't want to accomplish something at the cost of so many other people's happiness or lives or even just my own suffering in getting worse. And see, I think what we see here from David is that, especially when there are times of brokenness, there's often two choices in front of us. In that moment, back when I read in chapter 19, when there's this picture of David weeping and broken and sobbing, mourning the death of his son, who, yes, tried to kill him, but still, it's his son. He's completely broken in this moment. And in that moment, there are two choices before him. Do I seek the Lord and rely on him to see me through this moment? Or do I chart my own path? And what we see here is that David charts his own path, and it leads to so much heartache. But I have to believe, because we've seen it in David's own story before, that if we turn to the Lord, if he had turned to the Lord and said, God, what would you have me do? That the story would be very different. See, I think for many of us, we have these moments. Things happen in our life. Their brokenness, their hardships, their suffering, and we're not sure how to move forward. And we have a choice. Will we seek and rely on God, or we choose to do our own thing? Now, it sounds kind of like, okay, that's simple. I seek God, I rely on him. But part of this is, A, are we seeking God? Which means what? We turn to him, we ask him, we implore him, we seek his face to say, God, what would you have me do? And we wait on that. We press into that. We look for his discernment and his wisdom and his guidance so that we would say, okay, now I know what I should do. And the relying on peace is where we say, I'm actually going to do what you've said. So that if you say to wait, I will wait. Or if you tell me something that I don't quite understand or quite comprehend or quite agree with, that if I can tell this is from you, God, I'm going to trust and rely on you, that your way forward is better than my way, and I'll believe. Because we can believe, as it says in Proverbs, that his ways are higher than our ways, and they're better. I think if David had done that, as we see him most of his life do, this would be a different story. This kind of reminds me of what I think a lot of us do. I have 5 kids, and so I've watched a ton of kids' movies over my life. And in one of them, Finding Nemo, there's a fish named Marlin who's looking for his son Nemo, and he has a very forgetful fish named Dory who is with him. And they're traveling, looking for something. And at one point, they have no idea how to get to Sydney. And they ask a school of fish for directions. But Marlin has no patience, so he can't listen to the directions. He kind of just tries to, like, do his own thing. But Dory talks to the school of fish and gets the actual instructions on what to do. And part of the instructions are, when you see this scary, like, chasm, go through it, not over it. And she's like, okay, I got it. And so they go, they find the crazy, scary chasm that you would normally, as a very little fish, think, I'm never going through this chasm. And they see this crazy chasm, and Dory's like, no, we have to go through it, not over it. And Marlin's like, that's stupid. That makes no sense. That is not the way we should go. And so he knows if he can just be like, he's like, hey, Dory, look at that. And she's like, what? And then she forgets what's going on. And then he's like, let's go over. And so they go up and they go over into a school of jellyfish, which could kill them, and almost does. And I think a lot of us are kind of like this. I think a lot of us get instructions from the Lord that are like, go through the crazy chasm. It doesn't seem to make sense to us. It's not common sense. It's not something that with our current understanding of the world or situations, we're like, yes, I agree with you. I get it. but God still knows what he's doing. And for so often, for so many of us, we don't seek or rely on God. And so we'll see that and we'll go, no, I'm going to go over. And then while it looks to make sense, the actual end result is much worse than if we had actually done things God's way. But we only know after the fact. My hope for us is that we are people who in the midst and in that moment choose to seek God and rely on him to chart our course forward, to see us through whatever situations we're in, and don't rely on our own wisdom, our own strength, our own capacity. Because the best of us, our own capacity is still weak and limited. As I was thinking about this, I think one of the things that we need to think through as believers in this time is this last season was hard. It affected many of us in different ways and many of us in similar ways. What I want to give us a moment here in a second to do is to begin to ponder and reflect on the past 18 months, kind of pandemic season. Did we seek the Lord? Were we going to him and relying on him for how to handle our lives in the midst of a pandemic? Or did we just do things that made sense to us? I'm not trying to tell people what to do or not to do. I'm not making any comments on like vaccines or masks or any of that or staying at home. That's not my point. My point is, as the pandemic happened, in the midst of the pandemic, during the pandemic, the beginning, the end, the middle, all of this, portions of this, as we even look forward to the fall, as we're in this place, are we seeking the Lord? Are we relying on him to give us direction on how we are to live our life and move forward through this next season? Did we do it for this last season? Or did we just do what made sense to us? Because I know in my own life, as I look back at the last 18 months, there were plenty of opportunities where I could see my life and go, yeah, I just did that because it made sense to me. I don't think that's okay. And if we're honest, I think for some of us in a moment, I think we need to just repent of that and say, God, I'm sorry. I didn't seek you. I didn't rely on you. I relied on my own feelings, my own comfort level, news articles, or wherever the other sources may be. I trusted them more than I trusted you, and I'm sorry. And I also want to challenge us in the same time as we look at what happened the last 18 months, as we look towards the next 6 months, this fall season, are we going to seek him to see our way through? Or are we going to rely on our own wisdom, our own capacity to make all the decisions for our life? I implore you, seek him, rely on him. Because even if it doesn't make sense to you, even if it's scary, even if it's like, I don't get this, his way is always better. Better doesn't necessarily mean more comfortable or easier or more luxurious, but it is better. So I'm going to invite the worship team to come on up, and they're just going to just kind of play some instrumentals just for a minute or two. And this is actually what I like us to do, is I want to give you time to just ask this yourself, look in your own heart and see, especially for this last 18 months, where did I go my own way? Where are places that we need to repent of and say, God, I'm sorry that I picked my own way and failed to seek you, refused to seek you or rely on you to see my way forward? And to just repent of that and say, God, I'm sorry. I don't want to do that anymore. so I'm going to give us that time. And as we kind of look for that, as I said a minute ago, I also want you to give a moment for the Lord to kind of speak to you about, as you're looking forward to your future, have you sought the Lord? Are you relying on Him? Or are you making plans again, pathways again for you that had nothing to do with Him? And if that is, let's stop that and say to the Lord today, I want to seek You and rely on You to see me through. And so as they're just playing some instrumentals, I'm just going to give you a chance to do that right here. And then in a minute, I'll lead us through a time of communion.